Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
In this episode, we're going to talk about one of the greatest rivalries in all of football that's lasted over 130-some years, and it's at the high school level in Eastern Ohio as Canton McKinley and Massillon, and George Bozica, the great historian that lives in that area, is going to tell us all about it right now in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. Your host, Darren Hayes, is podcasting from America's North Shore to bring you the memories of the gridiron one day at a time. So as we come out of the tunnel of the Sports History Network, let's take the field and go no huddle through the portal of positive gridiron history with PigskinDispatch.com.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at SportsHistoryNetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of PigskinDispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pigpen. We have a very interesting topic tonight. We're going to go with a little bit of high school level rivalry in one of the longest standing rivals of high school football, and that takes place in Ohio. And George Bozica, our friend, a long time Canton resident, is going to tell us about the Canton McKinley and Massillon rivalry. George Bozica, welcome back to the Pigpen.
Thanks, Darren. Always look forward to these podcast discussions with you.
Yeah, you brought up this topic that you're going to talk about tonight. I find it extremely intriguing because there's something about high school football. I mean, it's all areas of the country. We're all affected to it. You know, we don't always have Division I college, don't always have pro level in our cities, but high school, everybody's got a rival. And when you're talking about, you know, a real heated rivalry like this one, it's pretty well known. And I'm excited to hear about the history of it.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because, you know, growing up in Ohio, Northeast Ohio, and basically having been part of this, the rivalry that we're going to talk about, which is just so we get it out there, the Canton McKinley Massillon high school football rivalry. The thing that I think interests me the most that in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Florida, Texas is that, you know, these Friday nights in these areas, you know, it's ingrained into the communities, you know, the whether it's in Massillon or, and you know, in Ohio too, you have a lot of blue collar communities too, as you do in Western PA. And so this is a big thing, you know, I mean, these areas, you know, obviously they, in Ohio, we follow the Browns or the Bengals, and, you know, we follow Ohio State, and, you know, in Pennsylvania, obviously you follow the Steelers, or if you're on the, you know, eastern part of the state, you may follow the Eagles, but you know, every community has their high school team, and that's sort of the place to be on Friday nights. So, you know, that's sort of, I think, the joy of high school sports at any rate. But yeah, this is a rivalry that I think having grown up, and I don't think I'm alone in my opinion, is probably the greatest high school rivalry in the country. And as I said, it's Canton McKinley and Massillon.
Maybe if we could sort of start at the beginning, how old are these two high schools and how long has the rivalry been going on?
Yeah, the rivalry actually started in 1894.
Wow,
actually,
that is way back.
Yeah, actually on October 23rd, a week from Saturday, or on October 23rd, basically Saturday is going to be the 132nd game in the rivalry. And it started in 1894. It's known as the War of 1894. Also known as the game. You know, it started back in the, as I said, late 1800s. Canton and Massillon are basically 8 miles apart on Route 30, which is the old Lincoln Highway. And basically they're 8 miles apart. Some feel that the rivalry actually had some of its genesis from the fact that you had the pro Canton Bulldogs and the pro Massillon Tigers in the old Ohio League, which was a predecessor of the National Football League. And it was a very, very heated rivalry. And when, you know, obviously the Canton Bulldogs continued into the NFL when the NFL was born in 1920, as we all know. But the Masson Tigers never were part of the NFL. They were part of the early discussion, but they never made it into the NFL. But that rivalry was so intense that it carried over to the high school rivalry. And that's why a lot of people feel the high school rivalry is as intense as it is. Also, some say it was an economic thing to the two communities, two blue collar communities, just were very, competitive, even economically. So that's where it got its genesis. Maslin currently leads the series 73, 53 and five ties. And they have, between the two schools, they have won 36 state championships, 11 national championships. And between the two, through last week's games, they've won 1,772 games between them. So these are two of the winningest high school programs, in the whole country. As I said, the first game was in 1894. Canton won the first game 16-6, Pastime Park in Canton. Canton actually dominated the early part of the series. They won 13 of the first 14 games with one tie, which I thought was really interesting, because if you look at the Maslin leads the series by almost 20 games, obviously they started in a hole. But once the modern era, which I'll get into, started, that's when Maslin really started to take off in terms of sort of, for a long while there had sort of dominated the series. And, the series has gone through its ebbs and flows throughout the years. I think one of the things that makes the rivalry so significant too is the people that have been attached to the rivalry. In some ways, there have been players that have played in the series. There have been coaches that have coached in the series that went on to bigger and better things. And as we go through the history, I think you'll see, what I'm talking about. One of the early names who actually was an assistant coach for McKinley was Dr. Harry March. Now, Dr. Harry March may be familiar to football historians because he is considered a person that wrote sort of the first history of pro football. Pro football, its ups and downs. It wasn't necessarily an accurate history. Some people said it was actually maybe a bit fiction, but he is credited with writing the first history. And actually, he was also had involvement with the Canton Pro Bulldogs. He was their team physician. And in addition, he also was real instrumental in organizing the New York Giants. And for a number of years, he served on the NFL's executive committee. And actually, in 1934, he helped start the American Professional Football League and served briefly as its president. He had the idea that there could be two pro leagues. He really wasn't looking necessarily to compete with the NFL, but, he got a little bit, though, sort of discouraged. And that's why he only was president for a short period of time. And actually, in his obituary, the New York Times called him the father of professional football. I don't know if that's a bit of a reach, but he was obviously a very instrumental person in the early history of pro football. And he's one of the first sort of key names that had, a tie to the series, and that he coached in Canton from 1903 and 1904. So he's one of the sort of the first sort of names that, sort of came out of the series.
It's interesting that you bring up Dr. March, because we're going to have his grandson, great-grandson, Alan March, yes, coming on to talk about him. And right. I think in the next 2 weeks, he'll be on talking about him. So very interesting.
Yeah. His book, actually, I was able to track down a copy of his book on eBay a number of years ago. And it's really is, like I say, it's one of the first histories. I think some people have said, that obviously in any book about something like that, it's probably based on his recollections and everything. And some people have said that, that some parts of it may not be as accurate as others, but nonetheless, he was the first one to actually sit down and do that. And I think that's really significant. And he was definitely, like I said, a really significant, person in the early history. Two other names. We all, I think, have heard of the Four Horsemen and the Seven Mules, Newt Rockne's famous team. Well, a member of the Four Horsemen actually played for Maslin, and a member of the Seven Mules actually played in McKinley at the same time, pretty much the same time. Harry Stooldryer, who was one of the Four Horsemen, was a quarterback at Maslin in the from 1917 to 1919. And Edgar Rip Miller who was part of the Seven Mules, played for Canton McKinley from 1918 to 1920. And actually, during that time frame, Masson won the 1919 contest 21-0, and then McKinley got some revenge in 1920, winning 14-0. Obviously, one of the most famous teams in college football history, with Newt Rockne as their coach, and actually two of them got their start, you know, in Masson Canton area. Newt Rockne actually at one time played for the pro Masson Tigers back during the during this time frame.
That's
so
great.
At any rate, the series, when it started, it was basically a regular season game. But in 1913, that was the first year that they actually played it as the finale of the season. And to this day, it's always the last game of the regular season. It's always played on a Saturday. It can draw anywhere from, 15,000 up to 24,000 people.
Wow. That's a big high school game.
Yeah. I always tell people that, having gone to the game since 1965, that it's unlike any other, high school game. And I've heard other people say that, because most people go to your Friday night high school game, maybe if you're lucky, you get a couple thousand people. They're smaller stadiums. Masson and McKinley through the years always drew well. And, it was not uncommon for them to have, these huge crowds with tailgating and everything else the day of the game. I always tell people it's more of a college atmosphere when you go to the game. Now, last year, obviously, with COVID, they had one of their smallest crowds in years. I think that the total attendance was around 1,700 people. So that's really unusual when you see the attendance figures throughout the years, and then you see all of a sudden 1,700 last year. But it's just all part of the world we live in right now. There just weren't as many people. It was a strange feeling being at the game last year with that, a few people in the stadium, because it was just, unusual.
Did they have a restriction on the amount of people that could attend the game?
They did. Throughout last high school football season in Ohio, they had restrictions, and they basically went back to normal crowds this year. But yeah, there was restrictions all through last season. It was mostly family members and that type of thing. So yeah, they were really restricted all last year.
Yeah, I think we had a similar thing in Pennsylvania. I think each player was allowed to have two family members attend, and near the end of the season, they would allow two more tickets per player or something you could get in. So very small crowds everywhere, but 1,700 is still a pretty good sized crowd. Yeah. Most high schools around the country would drool over figures like that.
Yeah, yeah. As I said, the bowl school is always, well attended. I remember when I was a kid, my mom had some of her annuals because she went to Canton McKinley, and I would go through the football section in the annual, and it wasn't uncommon for even regular season games to see a crowd of 20,000 or a crowd of 21,000 or a crowd of 18,000. This was the thing to do back then. I think it's changed a little bit in recent years because I think there's so much for other things for people to do, that, sometimes I think it brings the crowd down. The experience that I've had is that the crowds still seem to do pretty well in mass, and Canton hasn't drawn quite as well as it used to. But I think a lot of that too is the passing of the wartime generation. I know my dad was part of that wartime generation, and him and his friends went to Canton McKinley. So it was a thing to do on Friday night, and then he introduced me to the game. I introduced my kids to the game. So, but with that generation passing, those are the ones that went to the game. And I think the same thing in Masson. I just think that it's more of a happening still in Masson sometimes than it is. And I think that's maybe part of the reason that there's been sort of that shift, but we talk about that all the time. And that's not to say, high school football still draws well. I just that I see some differences in terms of the draw over the years, but this is a game that always is going to have the biggest crowd of the year in the area. And actually, during my growing up years in the 60s and stuff, it wasn't uncommon for them to bring in extra bleacher seats. They would bring in temporary seatings just so they could seat everybody. And now I don't know you could get away with that now because of fire laws and everything else and safety rules, but they would bring those in and they would put them along the sidelines and everywhere else. And they would just jam as many people into the stadiums as they could. And that was the thing, you had those huge crowds. So it's always been well attended, both schools, and both schools have great traditions. Some of the Masson traditions, I think it's fairly well known in this area. I don't know how much it is outside, but every boy that's born in Masson gets a mini football put into their crib. And the boosters have carried that tradition on through the year. That's how important, football is in the Massillon community. The winner of the series, the winner of the series gets the victory bell, and that started in 1957, and it's actually an old railroad bell. And you know, that's it's a big thing. They usually roll it out at the end of the game, and it's on a little like pedestal and everything, and the victory bell goes to the winning team every year. In the 70s and 80s, this game appeared on most betting sheets. You know, not only did you have college and pro, but usually there was a line on the McKinley-Massillon game in betting sheets. And I actually remember seeing some betting sheets from that era, and I remember seeing the McKinley-Massillon game listed on the betting sheets. So it's just amazing, you know, that's you know where this game was, you know. So
now, George, with those giant crowds that you were just describing a few minutes ago, where are the games played at the same venue all the time, or do both schools have stadiums large enough to seat that many people?
Yeah, both, you know, through the years it was played, you know, at different places early on in the series. But in 1938, Fawcett Stadium was built in Canton, which was right next to the Hall of Fame. It was a WPA project. And Tiger Stadium was built in Massillon a year later in 1939. So the first McKinley-Massillon game at Fawcett was in 1939, even though the stadium opened in 38. And then the first Massillon-McKinley game at Tiger Stadium was in 1940, but it was opened in 1939. Now that's Paul Brown Tiger Stadium, named after their famous coach, who I'm just about ready to get into here in the history line. And actually, Paul Brown Tiger Stadium is at 1 Paul Brown Drive in Massillon. That's the address for the Tiger Stadium. Fawcett Stadium is now Tom Benson Stadium, the new stadium that was built as part of the ongoing construction of the new Hall of Fame Village. So at first they said that they were going to renovate Fawcett Stadium, but then basically what happened is Fawcett Stadium was torn down and the new stadium was built. And actually the last regular season game that was played at Fawcett Stadium was a McKinley-Massillon game.
Now, what's the significance of Benson and Fawcett? I mean, we know who Paul Brown is, but we're...
Benson, actually owner of the Saints, he made a large donation towards the stadium and helped with the building of the new stadium. So that was how he got the name associated with the stadium.
Okay. Yeah. And Fawcett, how about Fawcett?
Was actually John Fawcett. He was a local school administrator, and Fawcett Stadium had been named after him.
Okay.
It's my understanding. And actually I was at the Hall of Fame this year for our Pro Football Research Association convention. They're supposedly in the Hall of Fame somewhere. They're supposed to have like a little sort of a tribute to Fawcett. Although every time I go there, I forget to look for that tribute. And I guess next time I'm going to have to remember, because I remember at the time there was some controversy about the stadium, because you know, to this day, people still refer to it as a Fawcett Stadium, even though it's Benson Stadium, and it's not Fawcett Stadium anymore because Fawcett Stadium was torn down. But people still refer to it as a Fawcett Stadium. It just, you know, it's sort of like, you know, I know a lot of people in the area, the Indians are going to become the Guardians next year, but there's a lot of people in the area that insist that they will still call them the Indians, you know. So, you know, it's one of those kind of things with Fawcett. A lot of people wanted them to keep the old stadium, but, you know, they decided that, you know, they were going to move forward with the Hall of Fame Village. And obviously one of the sort of the crowns of that was going to be the new stadium. So, and it is a beautiful stadium. I've been there for a number of games. It's a beautiful stadium. So at any rate, but yeah. So
yeah, there's not too many high school stadiums that have elevators that go 8 floors in them. Like Benson. No,
yeah, it is. It is. They're two really sort of, you know, special. I think the capacity of Benson's around 24,000. I think the capacity at Tiger Stadium is a little over 16, like six. I want to say 16-6. So
those are big high school stadiums.
Yeah, they are big high school stadiums. So anyhow, the rivalry continued, you know, through the 20s, but by the early 30s, both teams were sort of going through some lean years. But in 1932, which is a really key year in the rivalry and the history of the two schools, two coaches were hired by each school that sort of took both schools into what's considered the modern era. And those were Paul Brown, who had played quarterback at Massillon in the mid-20s, and Jimmy Akin, who was hired by McKinley. Jimmy Akin went on, after his years at McKinley, he went on to coach at Oregon. And actually, when he was at Oregon, he coached both Norm Van Brocklin, famous Rams quarterback, and Eagles quarterback. And he also coached John McKay, who went on to coach at USC, and also obviously the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Again, here's this, you know, this tie-in to, you know, to the upper levels of, you know, pro football from the McKinley-Masson series.
I didn't realize that Paul Brown was a student that attended Massillon as well.
Paul Brown had coached at a prep school in Maryland, and then because of powers that be at Masson remembered him, thought he would make a good, you know, head coach, so they hired him in 1932 to become head coach. At the same time, McKinley hired, you know, Aiken. Within 3 years, the first 3 years Aiken was there, he beat Masson all 3 years, 32, 33, and 34. But 34 was sort of the seminal year. In 1934, they played basically end of the season game. They both came in undefeated that year. McKinley was 10-0. They played 11 games scheduled that year. And Masson was 9-0. Aiken had been successful, actually more successful prior to coming to McKinley, actually, than Paul Brown had. Paul Brown had the year or so at the prep school. He had coached at Findlay High School and actually won a state champion there, their state championship there in 1925. So he had that pedigree coming in. And, you know, he got the best of Paul Brown those first 3 years. In 1934, as I said, they came in 10-0 McKinley, 9-0 Masson. Going into the game, played at Masson Field, the Tiger Stadium had not been built yet, 20,000 people. McKinley had outscored their opponents going into the game 466-12. And Masson had outscored their opponents 421-0.
Oh, boy.
So these are two dominating teams.
Some good defense there, obviously, on both sides. Yeah.
The Goodyear blimp was there before the game, flew over the stadium. And 34 McKinley team, the Bulldogs, beat the Tigers 21-6. It was probably Jimmy Aiken's greatest team at McKinley. They were state champs. They were named national champs with an 11-0 record. And oddly enough, and maybe oddly enough, maybe not so oddly, the loss didn't sit well in Masson. You know, they lost three in a row. Paul Brown had not beat McKinley, their arch rival. And there was talk that they wanted Paul Brown's head. They were not happy in Masson. Well, in 1935, Paul Brown sort of came into his own. They went into the McKinley-Masson game that year 9-0. They had outscored their opponents 477-13. And McKinley came in 6-2-1. And they played at Lehman Stadium in Canton. Lehman Stadium was part of Kent Lehman High School, my alma mater. I went to Kent Lehman High School. It doesn't exist anymore. It's now a junior high at a different location. But it was a high school in Canton, and it had a stadium right in front of the high school, old concrete seats. And I saw that you would have to see it to believe it, but they said they used to be able to get like 14,000 to 12,000 people in there. How they did that, I really don't know. My dad said they used to bring in bleachers and stuff like that. They would close the streets all around it because it was right in the middle of a neighborhood. It's always fascinating to me, having gone to high school there, that, you know, Paul Brown coached there. I always found that just fascinating. He coached on that field, that same field where, you know, our football team practiced every night. So it was just amazing. Well, they beat McKinley that day 6-0. And Masson was named state champs and national champs. And that got Paul Brown going. Aiken moved on the college ranks, but Paul Brown stayed in Masson. And basically, I think he is responsible for creating the animal that we now know as Masson. From 1935 to 1940, he went 58-1-1.
Wow.
He won 58 out of 60 games. He lost one and he tied one. He won six state titles. He won six straight games over McKinley after having lost to them his first 3 years there, and he won four national championships. His greatest team, and it's considered one of the greatest teams in high school football history, is his 1940 team. They were led by two future Cleveland Browns, Tommy James and Horace Gillum. They went 10-0. They outscored their opponents 477-6 for the season. 11 of the players on that team made All Ohio that year. 11 players made All Ohio from one high school.
Wow.
They scrimmaged Kent State University that year. Kent State ended up that season 8-1. Masson beat them 47-0.
Holy cow.
And it was just an amazing team. The only team to score a touchdown on Masson was McKinley. McKinley scored the first points in the McKinley-Masson game that year. A running back named Athey Garrison scored a touchdown. McKinley went up 6-0 and then lost 34-6. It was an amazing team. It's been hailed as one of the great high school teams in the history of high school football. Actually, after that season, the Ohio High School Coaches Association urged Paul Brown to move to Ohio State. Now, it may have been, you know, that you could say, well, you could look at that one of two ways. If you could consider it a compliment because they were saying how good it was, but I also think that maybe they wanted to get him out of their ranks because he was dominating the opposition so much. So he did become Ohio State coach in 1941. And actually he said that his 1940 Massillon team could have beat his 1941 Ohio State team. That's how good they were.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Now, was he able to recruit a lot of Massillon kids from his 40 team to go to Ohio State when
he left? Some did go on to play at Ohio State. And actually in 1942, he won the national championship at Ohio State. So, he's one of the few coaches that won a high school championship, a national championship. And then also, obviously, as we all know, he went on to coach the Cleveland Browns and Cincinnati Bengals and obviously won, three NFL championships with the Browns. So, considered one of the great, innovators of all time. And his coaching tree is just amazing when you consider, he really came of age in Massillon, but then you consider, his coaching tree with Eric Parsegian, Chuck Knoll, Don Shula, Weeb Eubank, Bud Grant, Bill Walsh. You know, these were all people that either played for him or coached under him that went on to great coaching careers at both the collegiate and the NFL level. So, I think Paul Brown, I talked about the 1934 season being a seminal season and the rivalry, and then 1980 was really a seminal season for, I think, Paul Brown. And, I think he's one of the large figures in the history of, the pro football. I don't think his significance can be, he's just an amazing, person in the history of the game.
Yeah, obviously some kind of a light bulb went off when he lost to Massillon or lost to McKinley that third time in a row. And just to have a record like that, what would you say, one loss and one tie after that in his high school career?
Yeah, one loss and one tie after that. Yeah, so over 60 games. He went 88-2 at Massillon, and he lost four games his first season.
Jeez.
So, after that first season, he was just, they just, dominated. And, they also, were dominating the series and winning the six in a row. Sort of ironically for Kent McKinley, they weren't, slouches during this time frame. After Jimmy Akin left, their coach was John Reed. And John Reed went 39-7-2 at McKinley over his tenure.
That's a great record.
And five of those seven losses were to guess who?
Massillon.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. He went 39-2-2, except for the five games against Massillon.
No wonder they wanted him to go to Ohio State. You're right.
Yeah. He was just dominant. And John Reed had a running back who went on to have a pretty good career, Marion Motley. So, I think it's pretty much said that, Paul Brown never forgot Marion Motley. He coached against him in high school and obviously, was one of his, great players with the Browns. So I don't think he ever forgot it. I think Paul Brown, when he came to the Browns, throughout his career, he, had remembered these players. And so when he started building the Browns, he remembered, players that he'd had through the years, like I mentioned, Tommy James and, Horace Gillum. Horace Gillum was a great punter, and Tommy James, a great player with the Browns, throughout their AAFC years, and then going into when they joined the NFL. Also, Lynn Houston, whose brother Jim Houston, both of them played for the Browns, and Lynn Houston was on Paul Brown's 38 and 39 teams at McKinley, or at Massillon, I should say. So It's just this pedigree. He did, bring along some of these players. You had asked about Ohio State. He definitely brought them along to the Browns, and some of them did also play at Ohio State.
I'm still trying to pick my jaw. There's two things that you said in this time so far. I mean, first of all is that, Paul Brown winning national championships. I mean, he was the best team in the country at three different levels, the high school, the college, right, and the pro level, multiple times at a couple of them. That's unbelievable. And then the other thing is you said early on that this series has gone on for 150 years, which is crazy. That's a crazy amount of time. And you said that there was 30 state champion, 30 some state championships. So my rough math is telling me that 20% of the years that Maslin and McKinley have played, one of them has won the state championship.
Right.
That's unbelievable of years.
Yeah. And oftentimes the game would decide the state championship, especially prior to the playoff period. In 1972, before that, the state champ normally either by acclaim, by the acclaim of everybody, or through polls, just like college football had the poll champions for years. So through that time frame, actually the breakdown of the state championships, Maslin won 24 state championships, McKinley won 12. And then the 11 national championships, 9 of those were Maslin's and 2 of those were McKinley's. Now it's interesting because since the playoff era started in 1972, and this has been a source of, you know, sort of needling between the two communities, McKinley has won 3 playoff championships. McKinley won a playoff championship in 1981. They beat Cincinnati Moeller. Cincinnati Moeller, people may, has been, you know, through the 70s with Jerry Faust as their coach, who went on to Notre Dame. He had a little mini dynasty there. He had moved on by 1981, but the dynasty, you know, continued. Cincinnati Moeller is still one of the powers in Ohio high school football. They were pretty much considered almost unbeatable when McKinley beat them in 1981 at the Akron Rubber Bowl. It was a state championship game and they beat them 13-0. And they then went on to win 2 other state titles in the 90s. So they've won 3 playoff championships. Maslin has never won a playoff championship, and they're needled about that because they've never won a playoff championship. But, you know, as they've said, it wasn't like they weren't around. Maslin has played in 6 state championship games. The last 3 years they played in state championship games, and they played in more state championship games than any team that hasn't won a state championship. So they've been around. And they've won a number of regional titles. It's not like, you know, well, Maslin's not around anymore. They're in and around. It's almost like they've been jinxed. It's almost like they've been jinxed. They have not won that. And they've come so close the last 3 years. You know, they lost to Cincinnati Moeller twice in state championship games, one in 1980 and one in 1982. They lost to another Cincinnati school in the mid-2000s. And then the last 3 years, they've lost to Akron Hoban, which has been on a run recently. And then they also lost to another Cincinnati school. So Cincinnati LaSalle. So they've been sort of snake bit when it comes to winning that state championship during the playoff era, but it's not like they haven't been around. You know, they're still, you know, considered one of the 10, you know, best high school programs in the state. They just haven't quite gotten it done, but, you know, I sort of feel like eventually one of these years, they're going to get the monkey off their back and then they're probably going to win multiple, you know, playoff titles. It's just like anything else. Sometimes you got to win that first one. Look at the Red Sox in baseball. You know, all right, those years they couldn't win one, and then all of a sudden they did, and then they won a couple other World Series. So, you know, so I think it's just a matter of time. So.
Now, George, when you're saying that you're in the state playoff system since 72, are McKinley and Maslin, are they the same size schools, or are they in 2 different levels of high school football?
They both started Division I, although that's changed throughout the years. At one time it was like AA and single-A, then it was AAA, AA and single-A, and now it's like divisions. They both were in Division I until a few years ago. Maslin is now a Division II school, and McKinley is a Division I school. Actually, there were a number of years where they had a Maslin rule, or they called it the Maslin rule, because Maslin wanted to play up. So they were permitted to play up in the division because they still wanted to play Division I. So, but a couple of years back, they sort of, you know, were satisfied with the fact that they're, you know, Division II, and they've been very, very successful, you know, with, you know, playing schools more their size. So the year that they lost to the Cincinnati, they lost to Cincinnati Moeller twice, and they lost to a third Cincinnati team that was not Moeller. And it's escaping me right now, but they lost to them in the mid-2000s. And there was a real disparity in the number of boys in the 2 schools. You know, that was pointed out at the time that, you know, Maslin was really playing up to, you know, to that school, and that had many more boys versus what Maslin had.
Now, I guess the other question I have is, Now, does McKinley and Maslin both play in the same league or conference?
They did at one time. There was a league during the 60s called the All-American Football Conference, and it was Maslin, McKinley, Warren, Steubenville, Alliance, and Niles. And sort of the claim to fame from all of them is that they'd all won state championships. And it was considered one of the toughest, you know, high school leagues at the time. You know, these teams would, you know, they would just have, you know, wars during the regular season. And a lot of times those games were deciding state championships.
Jeez, when did the other schools have a chance to win anything? I'm just sitting
there thinking. They were all pretty successful. Steubenville, it was a successful, won a number of state championships. They've continued to win state championships during the playoff era. Warren has continued to win. Actually, one of Warren's most famous athletes is Paul Warfield. Paul Warfield played at Warren.
Oh, no kidding.
He went on to the Dolphins. Yeah. Alliance had a good football program. Len Dawson played at Alliance, Chiefs quarterback. And then you had Niles and also, that would be the team. McKinley, Maslin, Steubenville, Niles, Warren, and Alliance. So that was it. So, and it was a great league. And then in recent years, Maslin's been an independent, and McKinley plays in a league called the Federal League. And that's mostly, you know, teams from the Stark County area. So that's so they have that league affiliation. For a number of years, Maslin has wanted to get in the Federal League, but they have not gotten in. So sometimes some real competition in trying to get into leagues because, you know, some members want you in, some members don't. You know, they're concerned about maybe a team, you know, dominating. Sometimes there's bad blood between programs. So, you know, but so Maslin is basically an independent.
Okay.
And they play one of the tougher independent schedules, you know, in the state. So they've always been a school that's taken on all comers. If somebody would win a state championship in a year that they didn't win it, normally they would schedule them the very next year. And oftentimes they would beat them. So, you know, that was one of their sort of, you know, claims to fame was, is that they always wanted to be considered the best. So
iron sharpens iron type of ordeal. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Okay. So getting into the 40s, after John Reed left McKinley in 1940, obviously Paul Brown left, another famous coach became the McKinley coach for one season, Ben Schwartzwalder. Ben Schwartzwalder coached in McKinley for one season. Then with World War II calling, he went into the into the Army, World War II, and he later famously became coach at Syracuse. And won a national championship there in 1959 and it's a member of the College Football Hall of Fame. And obviously we remember Syracuse for the great running backs, Jimmy Brown, Ernie mm-hmm. Davis, Floyd Little, Jim Nance, Larry Zonka, all played under Schwartzwalder. Again, I often wonder, you know, what would have happened if he had stayed at McKinley and, you know, World War II, you know, had not come about. But oddly enough, one of the more famous coaches in McKinley history took over for Schwartzwalder, and his name was Herman Bupp Rierich. And Bupp Rierich is a name that's very esteemed in Canton McKinley football history. He coached from 1942 to 1949 at McKinley. During that time frame, he went 67-8-6. He won two state championships in 1942 and 1944, beat Maslin badly both years, 35-0 in 42, 27-0 in 44. Maslin had a 52-game unbeaten streak going. He broke the streak in 1942, beating them. And that was from the Paul Brown years into the early 40s with their next coach, Bud Houghton. And he broke that. He broke that in 1942. Maslin had a 52-game unbeaten streak. And so he was the coach that did it. So he's very well thought of. Sadly, he passed away in his 50s from cancer. But he was also a great basketball coach. He coached the McKinley basketball program throughout the 50s, even after he had stopped being you know, their football coach. As I said, Bupp is really well known in the area. Actually, it's interesting. As great a football coach as he was, every year during my sort of school years, they used to have four high schools in Canton: McKinley, Lincoln, Lehman, and Timken. And at the end of every basketball season, they would give like a player of the year in this, in the All City series. And the trophy was named after Bup Rurik. So he was just a great all around coach, which was not uncommon back then. You know, Paul Brown actually coached basketball too. I've heard through my dad that his basketball teams were sort of like his football teams. They were very physical and they would just, you know, sort of beat you up physically. That's kind of basketball his teams played. But he was actually also a basketball coach that I thought was sort of, you know, interesting. One of the more interesting games in the series in 1945, 50th anniversary game at Fawcett Stadium, the game ended up in a scoreless tie. And Masson that year was coached. Their coach that year was Augie Morningstar. That was the Masson coach that year. Bup Rurik was coaching for McKinley, Augie and Bup. And Masson that year had a very unusual record. They went 5-0-5. Five wins, zero losses, wow. Five ties. And actually that year, they played Cleveland Cathedral Latin High School at Cleveland Municipal Stadium, where the Browns played until, you know, First Energy Stadium was built, and where the Indians played until Progressive Field was built. And they drew 51,000 for that game, for a high school game.
Jeez.
51,000 people at Cleveland Municipal Stadium. biggest crowd ever Masson's ever had. The one year they played Cincinnati Molar, it was actually a doubleheader at the Horseshoe in Columbus for the two state title games, and that doubleheader drew 42,000 people.
So, that's amazing. Can't even imagine.
As we get into the late 40s, Masson had another great coach that came about, and his name was Chuck Mather. And Chuck Mather coached at Masson from 48 to 53, and in those 6 years there, he went 57-3. Beat McKinley 6 years in a row. As I said, there were certain time frames where McKinley would win, but then Masson would go on these streaks of just winning, you know, seven games in a row. And during that time frame, they won six state titles. Every year they won a state title because they finished either 10-0 or 9-1 every year. And they won three national championships to add to the legacy. And two famous people in football circles that Mather coached, in 1948, he coached John McVay. John McVay went on to be in the 49ers front office during their Super Bowl years. He was with the front office during their five Super Bowls. And actually, he's the grandfather of Sean McVay, coach of the Rams.
Oh, no kidding. Okay.
And he was known in NFL circles as the Grand Kahuna. That was his nickname. So he was a lineman for the Masson Tigers. And then he went on to this great, you know, career with the Niners. Another name that I'm sure will be familiar to people, 1949, played for Mather at Masson, Don James. Don James went on to coach at University of Washington and, great success there. As I said, Mather had these great years. In 1950, he was actually in the running for the Ohio State job. He lost out to Woody Hayes. Wow. Woody Hayes became the coach. But, you know, Masson during that time frame was always considered sort of a stepping stone to go into college and become a successful college coach. They actually wanted their coaches to move on. They didn't want coaches to stay too long. The thing was always, well, we want our coaches to stay maybe 3-5 seasons at the most and then move on to the college ranks. Some said it was because they didn't want anybody to beat Paul Brown's record of 80 wins. Some people said they just wanted their program to be considered a stepping stone, and that, you know, a huge stepping stone, obviously, but it was part of the legacy that they want. And, so that was always sort of the thing at Masson. Somebody would stay for, you know, seasons, be successful, win some state championships, and then they would move on.
But it had to be an attractive position for people wanting to up-and-comers in the coaching profession. And
Yeah. There, I don't know if it's an urban legend or not, but the urban legend at Masson always was that if you started losing games at Masson, the some of the fandom would put a for sale sign on your yard if you're the coach. So the fans usually knew where the coach lived, and that was always sort of the thing. As the joke around was, well, that if a coach lost a game that he wasn't supposed to lose, he's probably going to have a for sale sign on his yard the next morning. So it could be they take their football serious. So
I guess so.
Yeah. So as I said, you know, McKinley was going through, you know, some lean years. They hadn't beat Maslin since, you know, 1944, though, when Bupp beat them in 44. They won in 42 and 44. So they then hired a coach who went on to great things with the McKinley program. His name was Wade Watts, and they hired him in 1953. And basically it took him a couple years to build his team, and he won back-to-back state titles in 55 and 56 and went 20-0 over those 2 years. And he beat Maslin, you know, both years. And one of the great players on his 56 team was Wayne Fonts. Wayne Fonts went on to be the Detroit Lions head coach. So yet again, another, you know, person that played in the series that went on to great things in, you know, either college or pro football. In 56 and 57, Maslin hired a coach, Lee Tressel. I think most people in football know the name Tressel. Lee Tressel coached at Maslin for 2 years, went on eventually to coach at Baldwin Wallace College in Ohio, where he was there for a number of years, and he won Division III national championship there in 1978, and he's in the College Football Hall of Fame. His son, Jim Tressel, maybe even more famous than his father, he coached at Youngstown State, won 4 Division I AA national championships, went on to Ohio State, and won a national championship at Ohio State in 2002. And both him and his father are members of the College Football Hall of Fame. So the Tressels have this tie to Maslin. Actually, a program I have from back then refers to his, I believe it's his 3-year-old son, Jim. So I just found that sort of, you know, neat that, you know, here's Lee Tressel was coaching at Maslin at the time. And, you know, his, you know, because they would always have in their programs, they would always have a page just as you opened the program, sort of the coach's page where they would introduce the coach and talk about, you know, the coach and his family. You know, throughout the 50s, you know, he was a coach there for those couple of years. I think the key thing about the 50s part of the rivalry was those great Wade Watts teams at McKinley. A lot of people consider that with that 34 team that McKinley had with Jimmy Akin to beat Maslin and Paul Brown, lots consider that the greatest team that McKinley had probably after that, except for the, you know, the Bupp Rurick years, was that 1956 team. Most people feel that that's one of the great McKinley teams of all time. And they, you know, beat Maslin, you know, that year soundly to win their second state championship.
Wow.
So going into the late 50s, you know, after this sort of mini era of success for McKinley, Maslin hired a coach named Leo Strang. And over his 6 years from 58 to 63, he won 3 state championships and 2 more national titles. So Maslin was just continuing to win, you know, state championships and national titles. There was no McKinley-Maslin game in 1962 because McKinley was on a 1-year suspension. And that was the first time that they didn't play a game in the series since 1918, which was the year of the flu epidemic. So even though there was no game in 1918 because of the flu epidemic, they did in fact play a game during COVID last season. Strang later went on to Kent State to coach, another stepping stone coach that went on. I don't think I mentioned earlier when we were talking about Chuck Mather, he went on to coach at Kansas. He was the head coach at Kansas after Maslin. And he also even was a coach with the Chicago Bears for a short period of time. So wow. He used Maslin for that stepping stone. Because they didn't play a game in 62, in 63, they played 2 games that season. And the first game was a night game around mid-season. It was the first time there was a night game in the series. And then they played the traditional Saturday afternoon game, you know, later in the year. Maslin won both of them. They won both of them. And one of the famous players that Leo Strang had, and you may remember this from the Pro Football Researchers Convention of this summer, is Bob Vogel.
Oh, that's right. That's
Bob Vogel played at Maslin. I think even during the convention, he mentioned, you know, playing for Leo Strang. And so he's from, he was another Maslin player who went on to great things with the Baltimore Colts. So that brings us
And he was in Ohio State, too, in between there, right?
Yes, he was, because he told some stories about Woody.
Right, that's right.
During the convention, yeah. Yeah, he was a great storyteller. People that didn't have a chance to hear Bob Vogel at our convention this year really missed something. He was a fantastic speaker at our convention, just really drew the audience in with his stories and just, you know, very – some parts was very inspirational. He's just a great speaker.
He was very hypnotic with his Super Bowl III ring on, too, or yes, Super Bowl V ring. Super Bowl
five ring. Yeah. He played in Super Bowl III, the one the Colts lost, but then he played in Super Bowl V that they won. Yeah. I know. Everybody wanted to come up and see his ring. Yeah. So it seems like every 30 years there's a key game in the series. Well, we already talked about the 34 game. The 64 game was a key game in the series. The game was actually shown on ABC television. That may not seem like a lot today because, you know, ESPN shows high school games all the time, but back in 1964, that wasn't as big a thing, you know, then, you know, so that was really something.
And they were barely showing pro games in 64.
They were. So, and the reason that the game was on TV that year is they were both 9-0 going into the game. And, it was played at Tiger Stadium. It was for the state championship because there was no playoffs. So they were 1-2 in the state at the time. And there was two famous coaches that coached the teams that year. Earl Bruce was a Masson coach in 1964. He had just been hired. He stayed at Masson for 2 years before he went on to college ranks, ended up at Ohio State eventually. And McKinley that year, he only stayed at McKinley for 1 year before he moved on to college ranks, was Don Nealon. Don Nealon went on to obviously be a great coach at West Virginia, well-known for his years at West Virginia. Masson beat McKinley that year, 20-14, to win the state championship. Then they beat McKinley the next year, 18-14, to win the state championship. And they had to come from behind both years. They were both great games, and the 64 game was played at Tiger Stadium. 65 game was, which was the first game I attended. I was 9 years old. That was played at Boston Stadium. But back-to-back years, two coaches that went on to be college football Hall of Famers. So again, you know, the legacy, you know, sort of continued.
Amazing. So,
with that. Finally, in 1966, McKinley broke a 9-game losing streak in the series, and they beat Masson that year. Their coach then was his name was Ron Chismar. He was well known locally, and he was a McKinley coach and a real successful McKinley coach for about a 5-year period there in the late 60s. Masson really dominated the series through the 70s. And I think I mentioned then that with the advent of the playoff system in 1972 that started, and I already covered the fact that, you know, McKinley won a playoff title in 81, beating Cincinnati Moeller. But we had another famous player, or actually two players that played in the series, and that was Chris Spielman and Rick Spielman. Rick Spielman is Chris's older brother. But I think he's now the GM for the Minnesota Vikings. So another person, he was a quarterback at Masson. He's now GM with the Minnesota Vikings. And I think Chris Spielman is a little bit maybe more famous even than his brother. He played at Masson from 81 to 83. He was a running back, linebacker, went on to be a great, you know, linebacker at Ohio State, went on to play for the Lions, also the Bills and the Browns. You know, and oddly enough with Chris Spielman, Spielman was born in Canton, but he played at Masson.
No kidding.
Yeah. And I thought this was really interesting. He once said that the McKinley-Masson game is just as big as the Ohio State-Michigan game or any NFL championship game. That's what he said about the series.
Wow.
It's just as big. And you hear that from a lot of people, you know, that you know, it's not – that this is a high school rivalry, but it's that big if you play in it, you know, and he said that. And I think that's, you know, sort of telling about just how important the series is, you know, locally and to people that play in it. You know, it's one of those kind of things where you hear, you know, like, you know, Ohio State, Michigan obviously is a big rivalry. I know you're from Erie and I know there's a big rivalry up there with high school teams up there and other parts of the country. But you know, it's the kind of thing that, it's for bragging rights for the whole year. You know, I mean, you could be maybe not have that good a record, but if you beat each other at the end of the year, it sort of makes your season. And that's happened some years. You know, there's been some years, you know, when both teams were down, but, you know, whoever won the game had bragging rights for the year because it's talked about all year, you know, and that it's that kind of game. The next sort of key name is Tom McDaniels. Tom McDaniels was coach at McKinley, and he became coach in 1982, and he was probably the most successful McKinley coach against Massillon. He went 11-7 against Massillon. He was very successful coach against them. He went 11-6 during his initial tenure, and then he coached one additional season a couple years ago, sort of as a stopgap. McKinley was between coaches, and they brought McDaniels in for one season, and he coached one season. So during that time frame, he was 11-7. He's won more games than any coach in the series, either Massillon or McKinley. So he's probably the most successful coach that's coached in the series. And I'm sure people will hear the name McDaniels. His sons are Ben McDaniels and Josh McDaniels. And I'm going to get into that in a second because, as I said, the 1934 game was a seminal game because that was Aiken versus Paul Brown. The 1964 game was a key game because that was Bruce versus Nealon. The 1994 game was the 100th game in the series, and it was played in Massillon. Sports Illustrated covered the game. There was an article in Sports Illustrated. Bart Starr was at the game, and he administered the coin toss. Bart Starr, Hall of Famer from Green Bay. Pack Stadium at Massillon. Massillon won in overtime, 42-41, and it's considered one of the great games in the series. Actually, 2 weeks later, the two teams met in the playoffs. And that was the 101st game, and it was played at the Akron Rubber Bowl. And McKinley got revenge. They beat Massillon 27-20. And the crowd that night was announced as over 34,000 people at the Rubber Bowl. There was a huge, huge traffic jam, people trying to get into the Rubber Bowl that night. And some people didn't get in until after the game had started. It was that big of a thing. And I think what it was the buildup of the 100th game. And then it had been built up in the newspapers locally and in media. And I think the buildup and the game being such a great game going into overtime, you know, 42-41, it carried over. And then you had this huge crowd for the rematch just 2 weeks later. And Josh McDaniels, who went on, obviously, to be on Bill Belichick's staff at New England as their offensive coordinator and quarterback coach for Tom Brady, was a quarterback on that team in 1994. And his brother Ben was actually a younger brother, also was a quarterback at McKinley, and he played on their two state title teams in 1997 and 98. And he's currently with the Houston Texans. So he's also coaching in the NFL. McDaniel's brothers. And I've read that, you know, one of the reasons that I think Belichick saw, you know, thought so much of Josh McDaniels was is the affinity that he had with his father, because Belichick's father was also a coach, Steve Belichick. So I think, you know, he always, I've heard, has really respected, you know, Tom McDaniels and Josh. And the fact, you know, it's another sort of father-son coaching duo, and they sort of have that in common. But I mean, Josh did coach the Denver Broncos for a couple of years as head coach, not quite as successful as a head coach as he's been as an assistant. But obviously, you know, he's been, you know, there for a number of the Super Bowl victories at New England and a key part of that, you know, Belichick staff, and got their start in the Canton McKinley Massillon series, and you know, played. And probably two of the most important games in the series, the 100th and 101st games. So as I said, Masson's, you know, never won a playoff title, but, you know, they've had, you know, a number of times they've been in the Final Four, 14 times in the Final Four, six runner ups. In 2005, not quite 30 years, 31 years after the 94 game, or I should say 11 years after that, both teams were 9-0 again, and they played before 24,000 plus at Fawcett Stadium, and McKinley won 38-8. That was one of the few times that they came in undefeated, both of them, and one team sort of dominated the other. But they met again in the playoffs, and guess who won that one? Maslin, 21-3. And some people couldn't understand how a team could lose by 30 points and then just a couple weeks later, you know, win. But I was at both games, and Maslin just got off to a huge start. They sort of like hit McKinley in the mouth as soon as they got on the field, and then, you know, finished it off and won the game. The last game of Fawcett Stadium was in 2015, which McKinley won 30-28. And actually, they had already torn down half the stadium before the game. So all the fans sat on one side of the stadium, which was really strange because, you know, usually there's some separation between the fans. But they all sat on one side. And as I said, you know, last year, you know, one of the smaller crowds, a limited crowd, Maslin won last year's match 35-7. And actually, Maslin's had a lot of success here recently. They've won 9 of the last 10 games, which is why, you know, they have that sort of 20-game cushion now, having won 73-53 for McKinley and the 5 ties. So that sort of brings the rivalry up to, you know, current day. This year, Maslin's 6-2 right now. McKinley's 5-3. They're both headed, you know, for playoff berths as we sit. They both have games this weekend, which they're favored to win. So they should, if everything goes according to plan, they should go into this year's game 7-2 and 6-3. And it should be a real shootout again, because they both have, you know, solid teams again this year. And McKinley particularly has come along real well this year, and Maslin has too. So they're, again, you know, right up there. And, you know, both are expected to do well once they get into the playoffs again this year. As I said, Maslin's on a 3-year run of state championship games, and I just feel one of these years they're going to get it done. McKinley hasn't had quite as much success in recent years in the playoffs, but they have a new coach this year, Antonio Hall, who actually played on one of their state championship games, and he's now their coach this year. And he seems to be bringing, you know, some of that sort of old school mentality back to McKinley. And I think he's going to do well there. Maslin's coach right now is Nate Moore. And he actually coached briefly at Mount Union on one of the staffs there. And we know Mount Union's success in Division III. And Nate has done a really good job of, you know, getting Maslin to the point to where, you know, they're there every year. And, you know, he's really built a great culture again there. And I think McKinley is in the process of doing the same thing. So it just, it's a series that just goes on and on. And, you know, it just, I think it's unlike any other high school series in the country.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right there. I didn't realize there was that much star power in the coaching staffs and the players and, you know, 150 some years of those two schools playing. Now, that brings me up to a point. Now, I believe the mascots of each – McKinley's mascot is the Bulldog.
Yeah, McKinley is the Bulldog, much like the Canton Bulldogs. And Maslin is the Tigers. McKinley's colors are red and black. Maslin's colors are orange and black. And, you know, some of the other – you know, I talked about some of the traditions. You know, one of the other traditions before every game is they – I remember during a number of games where the game ball was brought in by parachute. They actually had somebody from one of the local sort of parachutist club come in, and he would fly in over the stadium just before the game, and he would land on the 50-yard line in his parachute and was carrying the game ball in his suit and his, you know, a parachute outfit, and then he would hand it to the officials, and that's how the game ball came in for a number of years. There usually is a number of balloons, red and black and orange and black balloons that are set off just before the game. It's always a 2:00 kickoff, the last Saturday of the regular season. It's been that way for years and years. And it's, I guess the best way I can describe it is it's a happening, you know, I mean, as I said, you know, you know, and as I said, the game still, you know, regularly is going to draw, you know, about 15,000-16,000 people. And in years like in 2005, where they were both undefeated, it still drew over 24,000 people. You know, and I think if we get to that point, I think this year's game will draw well because, you know, last year with COVID, nobody could come to the McKinley-Masson game. So I expect a good crowd this year with both teams, you know, playing well and being very entertaining. Starr County, which is where both schools are, it just has a love affair with, you know, football of any kind, you know, with the Hall of Fame being there and everything else. It's just a love affair. And, you know, no matter where you go around the county, you're going to see, you know, a good high school game on any given, you know, weekend.
That sounds like it. Now, going back to the mascots, now, did the Bulldog and Tiger mascot, was that prior to the pro teams playing there 100 years ago, or did the pro teams get named because of the high schools?
That I'm not sure. I probably would have to look that up as to when they did. So I don't know. Maybe this might be something that makes the cutting room floor. I'm not sure.
I mean, it's just extremely interesting that, you know, the area's pride, the town pride of each of them, mm-hmm. carries that mascot, two different levels of yeah. importance, yeah. to great things. Yeah. That's pretty nice and pretty neat.
Yeah. So, yeah. But I know that Masson has a really famous marching band. They're called the Tiger Swing Band. And actually, it was Paul Brown's doing that the swing band actually became what it was. He was sort of instrumental because he felt that, you know, football should be an experience all the way around. And so Maslin's swing band, they've actually played in the Rose Bowl parade and, you know, others. And then McKinley has the Marching 100, and, you know, they've had great bands over the years too. And actually Maslin and McKinley both had live mascots for a number of years. McKinley had a bulldog and Maslin had a tiger. Although I think because of animal rights laws now, I know Maslin can no longer have the tiger. They had to do away with that a couple of years ago, but they do have a student mascot, Obi the Tiger. And it's basically a full tiger outfit. And Obi usually is part of the marching band and, you know, entertains the crowd and everything else. So
that's probably a little safer than having the live version of the tiger.
They would bring the live tiger in. They would have it in a little, you know, cage with a big M for Maslin and everything. But a couple of years ago, they had to, because of some animal rights laws, they had they had to discontinue that.
That had to be quite the spectacle, I'm sure. I bet games where like a horse was used as part of the mascot, you know, if it was like a cowboy or a stallion or something. I don't think I've ever had a live, you know, big cat there.
it was usually a tiger cub is what it was.
Okay.
And they would usually, my understanding was they would get a different tiger cub every year. So.
Oh, no kidding. Wow. That is really neat.
Yeah. So very neat. It was one of their traditions until, like I said, a couple of years ago, but you know, they've still continued with, you know, a lot of the other, you know, traditions and stuff like that. So,
Well, George, I appreciate it. I mean, you have done an immense amount of research on here, and I can tell you're very passionate about this game, and especially attending for the last, 55, 56 years. That's tremendous on your part, going to these games, and your families for attending and everybody in the area. So, thank you very much for sharing this great rivalry with us. And, I tell you what, I'm jealous. I thought we had some big rivalries here, but when you're drawing in, you know, those kind of crowds every year, that's something special. And to have that many people, coaches in the Hall of Fame, players in the Hall of Fames, college and pros, that's just tremendous. So thank you for sharing that with us, George.
Yeah. It's really, researching it and, you know, staying on top of it is really sort of a labor of love for me. My dad who passed earlier this year, he introduced me to the rivalry and started taking me in 1965. And then I started taking, you know, both of my sons to the game when they got old enough to appreciate it. And, you know, during the time when my dad could still go to the games, we all went together. And it means a lot to me because of that. And I like sharing the stories about the games. I was one of the most thrilling things for me was when my son got my youngest son got his first radio job at WHBC in Canton. One of the first things that he got the opportunity to do was call the McKinley-Masson game on the radio. And then he's also called it on television. So it was just, it was sort of a things coming full circle, because, you know, I used to remember going to the games and, you know, listening to the buildup on the radio, and then to have my own son actually call the game in the area and also do it on TV was a big thrill, you know, for the.
And your father got to hear both those calls before he.
He did. He did.
That's truly tremendous.
Yeah, he did. So
that's really awesome.
Actually, because he was a McKinley grad, my son actually got him a McKinley Maston poster that he used to have in his room at his assisted living facility. And, you know, so until his death, I would always give him updates, because, you know, once he stopped being able to go to the games, I would always give him the updates on the games and what was going on and, you know, stuff like that. And he would tell me stories, you know, of going to the games. Actually, it was really neat, and it would be sort of the last thing I mentioned, the 56 game when they played with the Wade Watson won the championship. There was a picture in the local Canton repository the next day on the front page, and my dad was actually in the picture. He was one of the fans that came out on the field after the game, and he's right there in the center. And I had not seen the picture, and somebody shared it with me just within the last year. So it was really neat to see that picture of my dad, sort of, again, brings things full circle. So yeah, it's a game that means a lot to me and my family. So yeah, it's a special.
Wow.
Game.
Yeah. What a great game, great rivalry to be a part of. And I'm happy for you. I'm excited for you. And I bet you can't wait for this coming game this year, especially with these teams having successes again this year, and it will mean something. So
yeah.
So thanks again for sharing this with us, George. Really important rivalry, and to all levels of football, and a tremendous rivalry. So thank you.
Thanks, Darren.
We're taking a peek over at the chains and the down marker. It's fourth and long. We're going to have to punt the ball and get on out of here, but we'll have another series tomorrow for your football history headlines, so be sure to tune in. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast. PigskinDispatch.com is a proud affiliate of the Sports History Network, the headquarters of sports yesteryear.
Hey there, football fans. This is Ross, the host of the Pigskin Tales podcast. I just need a few moments of your time to talk about the host of the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, Darren Hayes. He's expanded the Pigpen to search out information on the history of all team sports. It's a quest to find out about the competitors, teams, and places chronicled throughout athletic history through the uniforms and gear the participants used and wore. And he is taking you, the listener, with him on this educational journey to preserve sports history on the Sports Jersey Dispatch, found here on the Sports History Network. His newest podcast, called Jersey Dispatch, is all based on the jerseys that all the greats used to wear. You can find Darren Hayes and the Pigskin Dispatch podcast, as well as Jersey Dispatch, on your favorite podcast provider multiple times each week. So remember that Darren Hayes, the host of the Pigskin Dispatch and Jersey Dispatch podcasts, it's found right here on the Sports History Network.